why not mix it up? Our guest is from Alabama.
Yeah.
Bingo.
Okay.
So thanks for joining us. This is We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
My name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape Machinery can get you pretty much anything you want when it comes to John Deere. Give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-22.
Yeah, 226.
226,
so
yeah.
Do the hand motions?
Yeah, yeah.
9226.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. I got to warm up here.
I wasn't even interrupting, just for the record. I was not interrupting time.
You're doing fine. Although, they're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake, and they've got a great inventory right now. Go up and see them, and they'll get you fixed up. Or you can catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Nice.
Yeah, there you go.
So let's see. Today would be June 11th, 2023, in case we replay this, because I think we will. It's a pretty fun topic, pretty interesting. So we have had like a hiatus, how about that, since we lost Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. And so we haven't talked about EMPs or any of that good stuff for a long time. And our friend Cynthia Ayers back there, she said, "Hey, I've got the perfect guy for you."
Mm-hmm.
So we're excited. You have a brand new guest, Greg Allison. He's the Alabama, hence the song, State Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. He's a subject matter expert in avionics system safety. I'm definitely not going to read the whole thing because it goes on forever, and he is involved in super interesting stuff. NASA, he's worked on the Artemis 1 space launch system, satellites. Let's see, what was the other really neat thing? He designed the architectural layout of the power and data system distribution for the International Space Station's nodes 2 and 3. We'll add more things as we go. But he also founded the High Altitude Research Corporation, HARC, to further develop the balloon-launched hybrid rockets. Won a NASA Phase 1 Small Business Innovation Research Grant, which is intended to be a paper study through which the HARC team actually executed a flight hardware program to develop and launch balloon launch return vehicle. All these things, and now we have, you know, Chinese spy balloons like flying over us. He has done a video called EMP Balloon Attack Threat from the Chinese Military, and I have linked that on the page. It's a YouTube video. It's on the page at wethepeopleradio.us, and if you click on June 11th, I'm also going to add Dr. Peter Pry's information to his page so you can go back and forth and listen to both. And we're just excited to have him on, and I'm excited because I found a lot of songs about balloons. So, Greg, I hope you like songs about balloons, because we're going to play those today for you. You seem like the kind of guy who could like some fun music. I mean, why not? It's a serious topic. We might as well have a little fun while we do it.
Amen. Amen, Aaron. Well, thank you, Aaron, for bringing me on with that introduction song, Sweet Home Alabama. I love it. You made me feel at home.
There you go.
Right off the bat. That song's used a lot in movies, too, if you haven't noticed.
They use it a lot everywhere, and I was like, yeah, but it's such a great song. I'm definitely going to use it. I'm going to get rid of our regular bumper music. Let's get right to it.
Awesome, awesome.
So Bill watched your video, and I watched your video, and we still are complete dunces about this, so we'll just shut up. And
well, the one thing I did learn is that we better start smartening up on this, or else we are going to be in a world of hurt.
We did learn that.
Yeah, and if the worst does happen, I think you can pretty much count on not surviving. It's that serious. So take it away, Greg.
This is very serious. And the problem is that now the threat from high-altitude balloons, especially from China, is much greater than even you dare to imagine. China has already conducted tests of the military weapon deployments from balloons, and according to some sources, they've even developed a branch of their military that can literally launch swarms of thousands of high-altitude balloons that can serve as decoys, platforms for reconnaissance, bioweapons delivery, bombs, missile launches, and worst of all, of course, is this high-altitude electromagnetic pulse as a sneak attack in a way that would be very hard to detect and very hard to defeat. And furthermore, It's all too easily done, and it actually is cheaper than the missiles. So a lot of people just aren't appreciating what can happen from a balloon. I know this. You know, I happen to have the intersection of experience of having chaired a couple power grid defense conferences, have become the state director and the late, great Dr. Peter Vincent's prize, EMP Task Force on National Homeland Security. And, of course, you may know, and you posted my link to my YouTube channel. And I hope everybody to go there and watch my YouTube video on this topic and on EMP topics. And you will find that I've had Dr. Pry on several times and a couple of other people from our EMP Task Force, to include National Operations Director Glenn Rhodes and David Pine. Is a deputy director of national operations. So I've had General Ken Krasniak. I've had several guests on the show talking about the topics of EMP, including David Womack and David Tice. David Tice has produced that documentary, Grid Down, Power Up. They had, what's his name as the moderator, Dennis Quaid. So sometimes I get brain locked, guys. It happens to even us rocket scientists. And that's something a lot of people don't understand. They think of Alabama as being the most backward state in the universe. But actually, Huntsville, Alabama has more PhDs per capita and more engineers per capita than any place in the free world.
No kidding.
So
did not know that.
No kidding. And all in one spot. And y'all got a lot in California spread out. But we got them all right here in one area in Huntsville, Alabama. A lot of people don't realize you can't throw a rock in Huntsville without hitting at least two or three engineers.
No kidding.
That's a joke I've told for a long time. And so it's an excellent place to develop programs, launch balloons and rockets and do programs like that from. But it's my intersection of expertise of having went out to the ocean to launch balloons with rockets on them and my expertise with EMP that taught me how easy this is to do. And when I see what what China is doing in their balloon developments, I know they know everything I know. Because it's out there in the balloon literature. If they get that many people digging through the balloon literature, the balloon flight, and becoming knowledgeable of the systems that's available, it's frightening what can be done. For example, I led teams on a shoestring budget. First as a club project. I mean, as a small society club project. And we launched a balloon that made the Guinness Book of World Records for the highest altitude flight of an amateur rocket off the coast of North Carolina. But launching from shore can be done or launched from the ground, but it's actually easier to launch from ships. And we actually, as a club, did a ship launch. Now, we took a ride, we hitchhiked a ride on the NASA barge for this, but after that, we spun a company off and we rented utility boats. And it was totally commercial, everything we did. And the company was a high altitude research corporation. So I've been out to sea launching rockets and balloons a few times. It's, I've done projects from $70,000 to $150,000 that could, you know, have the balloon launch return vehicle, which was a unmanned aerial vehicle that was remotely piloted and with a rocket on it to launch from a balloon. And we did the HARC, Health Altitude Research Corporation, Chief Excess of Space Prize rocket called the Katz Prize rocket, which could have reached 100 kilometers. Now, most of the stuff that I talk about in the report has to do with launches that are actually detonations from balloons. And detonations from balloons, you need to be about 30 kilometers up to have the atmosphere to be just right to give you the most powerful EMPs. And so what that means is you've got to be where you don't. There's certain backscatter, and I guess the electrons will pull each other. What happens to the EMP is this. When the EMP, when a nuclear device goes off, it shoots out a lot of gamma rays. The gamma rays strip electrons off the atoms in the atmosphere. It's called the Compton effect. But anyway, they strip these electrons off and create a wave of electricity. And you get three waveforms from an EMP device. You get E1, which is a very high-frequency waveform which will fry things with smaller circuits in it, like maybe your radio, perhaps your cell phone, your car, possibly. Although cars are kind of, we don't know a lot about what's going to happen to cars. We think it's going to be hit and miss because a car is kind of a Faraday cage, and it's dependent on a lot of things. But you expect a lot of your important stuff to get taken out by the E1. But there's also E2, which is like lightning, and then there's like a massive lightning wave. And then there's E3, which is a long wave component. And you also get E3 from solar coronal mass ejection. E3 will be picked up by power lines, by rail lines, by pipelines, any long conductors, even deep underground and undersea cables will pick this up. I know some people think, well, we bury it, we'll be fine. No. Kazakhstan had a nuclear test known as Test 184, and I believe I mentioned this in my full-length paper. That test, you know, fried a deeply buried power line in Kazakhstan. And so we know that these things are far more capable than you want to imagine. So most of the, when we developed our first mill standards to protect us from electromagnetic pulse, they, you know, we were going off of our little, we shot up on a redstone arsenal back in 1962, and it was called Starfish Prime. We shot up over the Jason Atoll, and this is before we had modern electronics. And bear in mind, too, Hawaii don't have long-range power transformers and power lines because it's an island. And that's the most vulnerable thing here in the United States. So they didn't have the kind of stuff back in 1962 to be as vulnerable as we did today. But still, it blew out street lights and had an impact on the grid in Hawaii, which was quite a distance away from Johnson Atoll. So today, fast forward to today, and you go to mainland United States, the most vulnerable things in our grid is those long-range, high-power transformers, which you could get the coils burned out in those things. And they're hand-wound coils. It takes 18 months to replace them. So if you fry these out, you can't get one in the loading dock into 18 months. But if they're all fried, how are you even going to order them? There's no bank accounts, no money. Your internet use requisition is gone. And according to the MP Task Force, the National Homeland Security, within a year, the societal collapse will take out 9 out of 10 people because you won't have water, you won't have power, you won't have communications. I mean, you can't pump water that power. You can't pump gas and trucks stop rolling. Your entire supply chain breaks down because you can't order replacement parts to keep the diesel trucks running if they could get the fuel. And they're not going to get the fuel either because they can't pump it in most cases. The refineries are going to have issues. Being able to run the refineries without power and all the infrastructure it takes to run them because, you know, things break down. You got to have replacement parts. How do you get to replace? The whole society unravels. If you think the supply chain issues, the recent Cerveza bug or whatever you want to call it was, I'll be terminology used here because I don't know how susceptible your platform is to challenges.
We get to say kind of, you know, I mean, it's the public airwaves, so we can't swear about it, but, you know, we can talk crap about the corona thing all the time.
I'm used to being on YouTube, and the platform will ding you for anything, so we have to learn code talk. So pardon me if I do a little code talk, but I'm used to covering things on YouTube, and it's like walking on thin ice in an earthquake with meteorites slamming ice all around your artillery shield or something.
And cleats.
Yeah, every time you say a word here, you got a cleat on it.
All of a sudden you hear
that semi.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it's like on YouTube. So especially when you cover these kind of topics that, you know, that I'm so off the cover. You know, my channel, I actually started my channel, and believe it or not, is an urban gardening channel. Here I'm a space guy, and I started an urban gardening channel. And somebody,
I thought you were like a worm farmer or something, right?
Yeah, I'm a worm herder, too. Rocket scientist and worm herder. I think worm herder is a higher calling. But anyway,
that's the greatest thing ever. I was like, oh, my gosh. I just, besides the fact that, you know, losing Dr. Pry was a massive loss for the whole world, I thought he would just love this. I mean, this would be like, let's have you both on. And he would just, there was nothing made me happier than to hear him laugh because he didn't laugh that often. And every now and then.
He was so fun to talk to.
He really loosened up and we just had a great time with him. Yeah. He'd come on like on holidays and I called him once and I said, hey, you know, you realize the day you booked is Father's Day? And he goes, yeah, I know, but it's Father's Day, so I can do what I want. I'd rather come on the show. And I was like, your family probably hates us. It was a lot of fun. Well, we really loved him. We better take a really quick break here, and then we're going to come back. We have Craig Allison will be our hostage, actually, for the entire 2 hours while we speak more on this topic. You can find us at We the People, and the website is wethepeopleradio.us. Good job, Bill.
Hey.
Would you like to ride? Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon?
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana safety message. Is your marijuana killing you? A testing of 1,000 NorCal dispensary samples found the majority had toxic mold or substances harmful to humans. As a bud tender, recommended THC products for treatment of medical conditions while you get sicker or exacerbate mental health issues. Get professional medical help and sue the dispensaries for the product and advice liability. Marijuana is not medicine for most Americans, and there's no medicine that is smoked. Remember, let's be careful out there.
That's what I thought was so funny about
that,
it.
That was an early song about the balloon swarms you're talking about.
Back to you, Greg.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting stuff there. So, guys, talking about how easy this is to do, from a ship at sea, it's easy to launch a balloon. On the ground, you have to have all kind of – the big balloons require a lot of special handling equipment. You have to lay it out in the direction of the azimuth of the wind. And then usually they hold the balloon really close to the ground as they inflate it, and they lay it out a little bit again because you don't want the wind to knock it over, because the balloon is a huge – you know, they might be over a million cubic feet in an envelope of a balloon, but that envelope is a very thin polyethylene plastic that's actually like three times thinner than a sandwich bag. And
oh,
so
wow.
they're
like a
huge bale, of course. So that makes it easy to rip them and tear them, and they don't want to do that. So they have a lot of special handling equipment on the ground to manage and keep it down in case the wind dust comes up. And then when they launch it, it's like they got this crane that rolls with it and releases it as it goes up. And so there's a lot of very complex equipment to launch a really big balloon on the ground. But it's easy. I've launched them on the ground. I've done them with my own makeshift equipment, laying them out in the direction. I use my own little launcher type stuff, not quite a crane, but we've done this. But from a ship, all you got to do with a ship is go in the same direction and speed as the wind, the same wind vector exactly. And you can let that balloon stand straight up. It's called freestanding inflation, and as long as you haven't got it inflated where it's going to take off like a rocket, where, you know, the thrust exceeds your weight so much that it's got a high rate of acceleration, you can almost launch it like a butterfly out of your hands. Mm. But if you got too much, you know, thrust on it, too much buoyancy, and it was what it is with balloons, it might jerk your arm off or pull you up with it. But anyway, we find launching from ships to be by far far easier than launching from the ground. And you can launch a big a balloon on a very small boat. The balloons that I tuck up rocket packages weighing up to 300 pounds were on the order of, we might have used 500,000 cubic feet in some of these balloons, 250,000. They were very easily launched on small boats. We used what they call a utility boat, which is just a basic work boat like they use out in the Gulf. It's not even a supply boat that's carrying supplies. It's smaller than that. And it's definitely not a cargo container ship. Well, you know, China has huge fleet of cargo ships. They can easily launch the biggest balloons there are. But you don't need a balloon that big. I mean, if you don't think of a balloon that big, maybe you're sending up, six missiles with nukes on them to go long range, which is doable, actually, unfortunately, or maybe more. I will send up rockets. My rockets were capable of reaching over 100 kilometers in altitude that I was sending up on these balloons. And that gives you a big footprint of what it could reach. Three rockets, like my Hart Prize Cat's Prize rocket, could EMP strike from that could almost cover the continental United States. Now, you've probably seen, or some people that have followed this topic have seen, the concept for a high altitude burst that would be at the altitudes of 480 kilometers, 400 kilometers, say over Omaha or Kansas, somewhere in that area. And you see, you cover the entire continent of the United States, practically, so maybe Maine, with a waveform strong enough that you're right at the threshold of what they harden the military facilities at, which I started to speak to earlier. Now, but in the center, it can be incredibly strong. The scary thing is, see, what I said is we harden our facilities to a standard that was based basically on our idea that we might get, you know, some accidental EMP from nukes in general use and like Starfish Prime. But what's happened is Russia has invented something called an EMP super weapon. So we were worried about something on the order of possibly, a, you know, 30 to 50,000 volts per meter. Russia developed a system that could actually put out 200,000 volts per meter. Our original spec was to harden it to 50,000 volts per meter, and they've upped it to 85,000 volts per meter, but it still doesn't match the EMP waveform that could be put out by the EMP super weapon. And furthermore, you could... I've seen a presentation where a guy actually developed his own EMP generator, electronic version, and he had it in the van, and he set this thing off, and it was like 34,000 volts per meter is what he was outputting, and he was still defeating with that system the EMP safeguards in those facilities that were supposed to be hardened to 50,000 volts per meter. So our entire military so-called hardened secure network is completely at risk. This idea that everybody thinks, oh, not to worry, they won't do it to us because we'll retaliate with our submarines at sea if they take out everything on land. Our submarines at sea require an emergency action message, an EAM. Without that message, they're electronically set where they cannot launch. It's a so-called safeguard. If you ever saw, unfortunately, maybe Crimson Tide, which also had Roll Tide song playing in it. Sweet Home Alabama.
Yeah.
But it was one of those movies. But unfortunately, you know, at the end of that movie, they explained that the scenario in that would not play out because since then they had fixed the system where that couldn't occur. Well, when doing so, you've also tied the hands of the commanders in a true emergency situation. Like probably the most probable situation if we got attacked is we'd get an EMP attack, and that would possibly thwart all ability to give an EAM to our submarine fleet at sea. Our military command and control structure would be fried. Any satellite that was on the side of the Earth where the EMP occurred would be fried. If it's high enough to leave electronic cloud, yeah, the very first communications satellite, Telstar 1, was fried by the Starfish Prime. The first EMP fried the first satellite that we had up there for those purposes, Telstar 1. So that just gives you an idea that these things are real, they're powerful, and we are not prepared. The scary thing is that, like I said, it's too easy to do from a ship. You could do, let me give you an idea about range. Now, what I was talking about was the power, the concentration, if you launched it from altitude. But if you're coming down with a lower range with the same weapon, as long as you're, say, over 30 kilometers, you're going to probably produce a field, instead of being spread out, all that's going to be concentrated in a much smaller area. You're going to have a super strong EMP field. And the Chinese spy balloon, the one that came over the United States, was floating at about 50,000 to 60,000 feet. And so everybody thinks they're easy to take down because our jets were flying around them. But that balloon was at an altitude that's maximized for lower velocity winds. If you get down to where most passenger jets fly, you have the jet stream, what we call the jet stream, and you got pretty good velocity winds there. If you go to the altitude of the so-called Chinese spy balloons, you're actually in a lower velocity wind, which is ideal for reconnaissance. It's ideal for spying because you can loiter over your area a lot longer, especially if you got a little bit of onboard propulsion, which apparently they did. So that makes a perfect spy balloon altitude, but it puts it within the range of our jet fighters and that AIM-9 missile. You get these balloons up to 80, 100,000 feet. About 80,000 feet, you're going to be beyond the range of the jet fighters. You can send these things to 120,000 feet easy, maybe 140,000 feet. The actual Chinese spy balloon was set for 30 kilometers. At 30 kilometers, it's 18.64 miles, so you're going to be above the range of our weapon systems. Now, if you go look up the AIM-9 missile on the internet and study it, it will tell you it's got a range of 20 miles. You go, well, there ain't no problem. You can reach 20 miles. No, that's flying straight out from an airplane from where it's launched on the glide path. Going straight up, it can't do that because it's only got a burn time of maybe 5.4 to 6 seconds, which is a small motor compared to the overall size of the missile. So the thrust of weight, I mean, the specific mass of the system, the specific impulse, excuse me, is... it's low. The thrust to weight ratio just well, not that, but it's mass fraction. That's what I'm trying to say. I get brain wrong. The mass fraction is too much mass. It's just not good enough to make it reach altitude. At best, an AIM-9 going straight up is going to go maybe 10,000 feet. So that's about all you're going to get an AIM-9 aimed straight up. It's not going to get that cross-range distance that you see advertised. It ain't going to get anywhere near close to it because it just don't have the mass fraction or the burn time on that motor to achieve those kind of altitudes. It's going to be like shooting a roundup from an onboard fighter. Some fighters have these 20-millimeter cannons. Well, they're not going to go over 10,000 feet either. But even if you could get an AIM-9 up to the balloon, even if you could shoot at the 20-millimeter cannon at the balloon altitude, you're just going to make a bunch of holes in it, which, you know, it's kind of like this, these balloons are so huge. The biggest ones are the size of the astronaut, but even the ones I flew were pretty darn big. And you knock a hole in it, it's kind of like just opening a barn door. Or not even a barn door. It's not opening a door or window in a warehouse. It's not going to make a big difference. It's going to take a long time to degas it. The super pressure balloon, though, it was super pressure. It was a little bit easier to pop, but these are zero pressure. I think what they'll use for an EMP attack will be zero pressure balloons launched from shore from ships. They may send some over from China, but you're going to see those coming from a long time. So it's two kind of balloons, super pressure balloons and a zero pressure balloon. Let me step back and explain that. What we saw with spy balloon is what you call a super pressure balloon. It had an envelope inside of an envelope. The inner envelope in it was called a ballonet, and you'd put helium in it. The outer envelope that you would see actually contained the inner envelope plus air that could pump in and out of it for ballast and keep the overall shape the same. So it was a dual envelope system. Now, they can set the altitude on these to fly where the EMP spy balloons were, or they've actually designed that system to be able to take 1.1 metric tons to 30,000 feet. And it's very interesting they picked that 30,000 feet. Now, that's from their own agencies. It's very interesting that they picked the 30,000-foot set point because that is the perfect optimum altitude for an EMP attack. So that just speaks volumes to me as to what they're really going for here. That really concerned. It gets you out of the range of the jet fighters. So, you know, maybe you could take it down with a Aegis missile. But how many Aegis missiles do you have? Not that many, especially send a swarm of these over. Now, if you see them coming from a distance, you might figure out something to come. That's when I think that the primary attack would be from the zero-pressure balloons, which are cheaper. They're easier to launch. You launch them offshore. The zero-pressure balloons don't have an envelope in an envelope. It's just one big, ginormous Paul Bunyan sandwich bag with a payload attached underneath. They've got an open vent line on the bottom, so if they were ultra-thin, so if they were to try to overpressurize, you won't pop it. The gas will just escape out the open vents in the bottom. Or you have vent cubes, either vent cubes or open vents in the bottom. I've flown both styles. You can combine them. But the bigger ones typically have these vent tubes, which is also can be used as fill tubes when you're filling the balloon. So you can have like four fill tubes and be gassing it up to get it up real fast. So what happened most likely is they would go about 400 miles offshore with a zero-pressure balloon because if you had a radar that could look out and see this and from 400 miles, I'm saying most of our radars are like this are good at 250 miles or something like that. But if you had a radar that was looking over the shore and you saw it just as soon as it popped up over the horizon because of the curvature of the Earth, my friends in the flat Earth world, because of the curvature of the Earth, that balloon is already going to be over 80,000 feet from 400 miles out.
Wow.
A little too late at that point.
Bingo. Exactly. You're not going to reach it with anything you got. If you can mysteriously instantly transport your fighter jet with AIM-9s underneath it, too late. So that's my point. And they've only, and it's almost in range of shore from the EMP. So let me tell you about these EMPs from a balloon. From a balloon, the radius, if it detonated right there, the radius you can reach at we'll take different altitudes here, 30 kilometers, the radius is 442.34 miles. That's how far the EMP waveform would go. So you're already going to take out most everything on the shore, even if you're 400 miles out. So if you get this thing up to 120 kilometers, which I think would actually be their set altitude because it's harder to reach and get a little bit more reach with the EMP waveform. It's to be super concentrated EMP, super concentrated. At 120,000 feet, the radius is 488 miles. Now, I imagine they would set these things to drift really close to shore before they detonate. So you could take out all our coastal facilities, all our military facilities, ports, airports, the cities, the manufacturing. I mean, if you look, most of the thing we have is on the coast. If they want to reach inland, just detonate a balloon. This could be a small balloon. It could be a balloon smaller than the ones I was using to launch rockets from, because that was about a 300-pound payload. I could design a balloon, and I did this in my paper in my presentation. If you look on YouTube, I actually show how to design a system that you could send up that would be something over 150 pounds, and you could set up an EMP from that. And it would be an easier to swallow balloon than I was dealing with. And you could just launch dozens of these things. If you had two ships off the East Coast, two ships off the Gulf Coast, and two ships off the West Coast, you could devastate our entire coastal areas. Now, one side or the other, if you're not there, there's high-altitude winds. Okay, what I didn't say, once you get above that lower wind threshold where the part of spy balloons fly, you get higher. You get into higher winds, higher than even the jet stream, usually. So when you're at, 80 to 140,000 feet, you're in a high-speed wind environment. And you might be going 200 miles an hour even. It's usually a little bit less than that, but you can really pick up. So these balloons could start going toward inland really fast from that altitude. And they're going to be above range of most anything that might hit them. Now, the really smart people with this might say, well, they might try to EMP us. To stop us. And the problem with that is that balloon probably, the whole initiation mechanism might be something as simple as a wind-up timer that cuts a cut-down mechanism. Let's use a lot of balloons to drop the package. And the dropping the thing, it might just be it drops the, I would say they put sand around so we wouldn't detect the radiation, and then they drop the sand bucket that's around the nuke device, and the balloon will shoot up. Either way, it's going to get an acceleration. And if you should find a way to shoot it down, it's going to get an acceleration, which would probably trigger the cut-down device. And then the trigger on the actual nuke device would just be an accelerometer. So if it shoots up or falls down, it goes off. So if you let this thing get to altitude, you're in danger, and there's not much way to deal with it. You got to get it before it gets to altitude. Now, a lot of people will think, well, laser will take care of balloon. There's nothing. We can cut it up with a laser. Laser beams, even these so-called high-power laser beams and fried drones and all this stuff they talk about in their advertising now and ballyhooing, well, one, they're overhyped. But two, that's actually a short-range weapon because the laser over distance has a phenomenology called beam spreading. Your altitude of these balloons, you're 20 miles up. You've got to shoot through a lot of atmosphere. If you were shooting straight up, it might not be so bad, but you're going to have to shoot diagonally across the atmosphere. You get that balloon, you're going through a lot of atmosphere. Laser is going to spread out to the point that it's not even going to warm up the balloon. You'll be able to sit in the balloon, but it's going to be, that's not, if you were sitting up there in the balloon, you'd be laughing, oh, somebody's putting a laser at us.
What's the effective range of a laser?
Well, it depends on the system. A lot of that stuff is probably classified data. They got some shipboard lasers that have come out with them just released. They're probably the most powerful military lasers out there. The Army's got some that they put out. But the effective range, it works within the near tactical battle space, but not at a strategic distance,
right.
Not at a balloon distance. It won't work if for miles and miles that we're talking about. We're talking miles and miles and miles.
Oh, yeah.
Too much beam spread. It won't do anything.
All right. Hold that thought. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Greg Allison. We are talking about EMPs and spy balloons and all that stuff today. You can find us at
WeThePeopleRadio.us.
The world's spinning round like a loony balloon. Heading for a collision with Saturn and Mars, and we're narrow. generally missing the man in the moon. Spinning out of control, crashing into the stars. Have we all lost our gravity, reason and sanity? Is this the price that we pay? Have we all lost our way on this loony balloon?
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana safety message. Did you know that the marketing of marijuana is a misogynistic and racist activity? That's right. Most marijuana corporations are owned and controlled by rich, fat cat, white corporate types, and most dispensaries are placed into depressed communities of color. These communities can least afford the chains of drug addiction and corporate greed. For more information about marijuana, please visit sources like ALM, Americans Against Legalizing Marijuana, at www.aalm.info. And remember, let's be careful out there.
We're out of control on this loony balloon. Narrowly missing the planets and stars. Even optimists say that it's all gloom and doom. We've got to get somewhere or hit something soon.
I think that's obvious. So back to the lasers, because people do think we could use lasers to defend ourselves, but that's just not you just don't have that technology.
Well, they're good at the theater space, which means close to where you're fighting for some applications. So, but they're not good over long distance yet. We don't have the lasers that can do what we need for this application. So we're just not there at this point in time. I'm not saying we can't get there. I'm just saying we're not there at this point in time. So these balloons would be very hard to defeat with current systems. Your aircraft's not going to reach you. Your AIM-9's not going to reach you. You could get over the Aegis missile, ground-based interceptor, but we're talking millions of dollars of missile, and we only got a few of them, and they may send dozens, hundreds, or thousands of these balloons over. It may be a mix of balloons launched from China and balloons from offshore even. And there could be a lot of decoys, or it could be like the Japanese Gofu balloons that were sent up during the 40s to start fires, or spread rust disease to wipe out our crops. They could be carrying drones on board that could be used to have combat roles or intelligence roles. It could be a very big multi-pronged mission that they come at us with. So
when you were watching the balloons fly over the U.S. here, and everybody else was going, wait a minute, what? Balloons, they're flying balloons. I think most people thought that's such old technology, that doesn't really mean anything. But my guess is your hair was on fire.
That's a great weapon. That is one such a great weapon.
Yeah.
It's an asymmetric weapon because nobody expects it. Nobody's planned for it. And because of that, we don't have a good way to deal with it. And that's why, I know what you can do for balloons, and I know they're going to be hard to detect and hard to defeat, especially if they launch them offshore in the manner I'm talking about, because their mission time is just going to be a few hours. They could detonate these balloons outside of U.S. airspace, out over the ocean, and totally take out our coastal regions.
Yeah, that's even
reaching this country.
Right, and that's a scenario where we would have to first strike something that's in pretty much international waters. So how do you determine if it's a threat or not when it's 400 miles from your shore, which pretty much anybody can be out there?
Detection is going to be the key thing. And from shore, you're not going to detect it fast enough. You're not going to see this stuff until it's already too late. It's going to be at 80,000 feet, and it's going to be close enough. If you had some way of transporting something to it, taking it down the instant you could see it pop up over the horizon, and you don't, and you won't even know what it is when it first pops up on the horizon.
Sure.
The guys, the radars, if they could see it, which I don't think they will at that distance, they got to scratch their heads and pick their nose for a few minutes just to figure out what's going on. And then, well, what do we do about it? There's a better way, and it takes time to scramble fighters and all that, and it's going to be too late. So there's a better way to deal with this. And that's the good news. There's different ways. I think the best way to deal with this would be to have some drones flying offshore, off the coast of the United States, close to the edge of the ADIZ. I mean, let these drones get out there 300-400 miles out. And it's, well, they too are limited by range, but, you know, let them get as high as they can, maybe 200-300 miles out. Well, I say 300 miles, it'll be at least 300 miles out, so they can watch these areas offshore. And they will need to use side aperture radar so they could resolve threats out there in the ocean, and in conjunction with AI. What they would be looking for is the signature of a boat that's traveling for at least an hour, going exactly with the speed and direction of the wind. There's no need for most boats to travel in the speed and direction of the wind. If you see that, then bingo, you got something to suspect in terms of a balloon launch. And so then they need further investigation. Now, Predator drones also have side aperture radar, and they carry little missiles on them. They can actually include the A-9. And if you could go in lower and get this balloon before, if they launch a balloon, you just swoop in and get it before it gets to any altitude.
But again, if they do this in numbers, and they do send in like a swarm with a bunch of decoys, you just don't have enough.
You don't need a bunch of drones out there. You don't need a bunch. And as soon as they detect something like this going on, you might could call shore and get the fighters out there. You know, so you got a certain amount of time it takes to mobilize and get stuff on spot. But that's the good thing, is that if you catch this thing early enough, you know, by the time they release that balloon, it's going to take it maybe an hour to get to 80,000 feet, maybe an hour and a half to get to total operational altitude. So you got a little time if you detect it early, but you've got to detect it early. Drones can take down some of them. Maybe fighters could take some out before they get to great altitude. I think it'd be good to have a set of drones. I also think we ought to have some ships at sea that are also capable of launching balloons. For one, they could be monitoring for this stuff, and they could also launch balloons with long-range communication systems on board. A network of these would make up for a loss of satellites due to, say, an MP or a Chinese asymmetric anti-satellite warfare activity that would be aimed at keeping us from communicating, having operational intelligence, and from sending our EAMs out. I mean, they'll do everything they can to thwart us getting our EAMs to our submarine fleet. That's something a lot of people don't think that they're preparing for, but you know darn well that's exactly what they're mostly preparing for. They don't want our submarines to launch.
Right.
So they will do everything they can to avoid that. And, fortunately, the Dr. Pye taught us that the Russians actually can launch from the submarine bases. They don't even have to deploy their submarines. They're already connected in, hardwired their submarines where they're at, so they get all the intel they need. So, we're not prepared except the same way a lot of the countries. People think that we're ahead this way and that way, but a lot of these other countries have kind of outfoxed us in certain regards. And we're just not thinking that way. We're not prepared. We got this mantra, nuclear war can't be fought, it can't be won. Well, they can be fought, and they can be won. And unfortunately, the way to win it is to be the one that launches the first strike. Now, then you can take out all your opponent's systems, and with EMPs, you can take out the retaliatory capability with the submarines at sea. And that country's prostate. I mean, you're sitting there sizzling. The scariest thing of all is the following philosophy. The Russians consider an EMP weapon, the release of an EMP weapon, the set off of an event like that, to be electronic warfare. They do not consider it nuclear warfare because it does not impact the homeland. You get no radiation on the homeland that whoever's getting attacked. It's a pulse that takes out electrical systems. Initially, nobody dies directly from the EMP. Not a person.
True. Right.
But what happens is your society totally collapses because electricity is your Achilles heel, your bank accounts don't work, your cell phones don't work, you can't pump water, you can't pump fuel, your internet's gone, all your comm systems gone, the societal collapse over the ensuing year will take out 9 out of 10 people. You know, if you should have found a way to order that transformer, by the time it gets there, you got no technicians to put it in.
Right.
So, you know, right now we're having labor shortages. Just imagine where you'd be when 9 out of 10 people are gone and they're fighting over everything. You know, the country will be in turmoil. So, my humble opinion is, given that the difficulty of ordering the components and to replace them, you know, we're not talking about, you know, like we lose a transformer today and you order it and then you put it in, you know, X months later and everything's fine and you got the rest of the grid to make up with it. You know, you can reroute stuff, you got redundancy in the system. If you're flying these transformers all over the place with an EMP, you lost your redundancy. The entire grid's down. Oh, yeah, there's also, that's one of the most vulnerable things. It's the most hard to place. There's also something that's called a SCADA, Supervisor Control and Data Acquisition. A computer, it's kind of like something called a primary logic computer. People work in the industry know what that is. But so these things control, provide the electronic controls for the grid, and they were expected to fry too. But it's the transformers I worry most about just because they're so huge, they're so big, they weigh 200 to 400 tons. They're as big as a house. There's unlike only a half a dozen rail cars that can move them, a half a dozen truck trailers that can move them. And, you know, it would, and the production of them, it's like it at a rate of producing that would be commensurate to just a normal grid growth, maybe a few replacements. There's not much in the worry of replacement. These things do typically last a long time unless you get some novice design. They're all hand wound by experts. South Africa had a solar storm. They got a bunch of their transformers. Some of their transformers, they thought, well, we'll just do our own. But their guys weren't. The artist is doing this, and those transformers only lasted about 3 years. They fried. Mm-hmm. So this is a very crucial piece of our infrastructure, and what a lot of people don't realize is a lot of the electric current that's going to fry these things actually comes up through the ground tap. So you need surge blockers on the center tap, on the ground tap of these transformers. That's your main protection, actually. This signal travels to the ground. And all these people buying this stuff to protect their home, and they say, oh, we're going to shut the signal on the ground. Well, I think that's hilarious. But anyway, what you're buying is a cheap lightning surge protector at best. That's my humble opinion. But so I'd be very careful with this stuff. And what good's your home? You know, you might keep your home from burning. If you had something to stop a signal like that, maybe you can keep your home from burning down. But my faith and confidence is not in that stuff. Anyway, what, that's another story.
What was, you know, back in, I guess, the 50s when they were setting off all the nuclear tests in Nevada, they must have learned a lot about EMPs during that time. And were they just far enough out in the desert where it didn't really affect anything on the ground? Because obviously...
Altitude of burst and things like that. Yeah, it affected areas right around them. But that's also what we know, that if you set it off real close to the ground, you will get EMP effect.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely. But there is some mitigating aspects in the atmosphere that tamp it down some, as opposed to if you set it off at about 30 kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
You will get an EMP effect. There will be an EMP, but it will not be as powerful for the yield of the weapon as it would be if you do it at altitude.
Right.
Okay. So there's various atmospheric effects that mitigate it if you fire it low. But it's still an EMP, and it can still fire the devil out of stuff. In fact, when I was in the military, they taught us to disconnect completely. They have one radio system completely disconnected and locked up in Faraday cage. Because, you know, they taught us that even if you had the switches turned off, the EMP would jump the switch gap. You had to have it completely disconnected. You couldn't just throw switches off, not even the handbreaker switches. You might have seen these videos of these power stations when they throw the switches. They got these switch arms that open up and they go through the air and they move like 40 feet. And they're carrying this long bolt of lightning with them because the current don't want to stop. It's got, you know, inductance. It don't want to stop at first. It takes quite a throw to stop that current flow.
Right.
And, you know, it's just like a spark gap. And if you ever see a spark gap system, some of these spark gaps have got a good distance between the two sides, anode, cathode, whatever you want to call them, and that spark gap jumps. That's another reason. That and voltage division. Well, anybody that knows electrical engineering knows what voltage division is, and that's another reason. But even if you had to shunt the ground, and if that's all you had to worry about, it's not going to be a perfect system. So, yeah, well, I'm
I think most people
that.
Listening to this, if they thought that it wasn't going to be a big deal, most of the things that you've talked about, you know, we don't deal with this. I mean, we just don't deal with this in everyday life. So you look at it and you go, if there isn't a really good quality plan, we are all in deep, deep trouble. We're going to come back with our guest, Greg Allison. He's going to talk to us a little bit, too, later on about the National Space Society's policy committee that he's been working on here to harden the power grid. We've got a lot of stuff to cover. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Spacemen, planets, and lunar surface, here I come. Here I come. Loose balloon, how high can you fly? You're a loose balloon before you pop and you die. Loose balloon, you made that little kid cry when you took off for the sun. You took off for sun. People squint to look up just to see you fly away.